My name is Cole Ross.
And I'm Jala Prendes.
And you are listening to A Bonus Level, Long Delayed. We're talking about Phoenix Wright Justice for All. Jala, I want to apologize to you and everybody for not getting around to this. It kept on falling through the cracks of other homework for me.
Yeah, I know. You noticed that after a while, I stopped asking you about it.
I just was like,
it's not happening. It's not happening. I will let it go. I will play a different Phoenix Wright game in the meantime.
Yes. And we'll talk about it. But I got stopped at the same spot that I did the first time that I played this back in the day. But I will leave the kind of the other intro matter for you.
Okay, so continuing on from our previous setup from the last episode that we did, we are going to treat this kind of like WAF, not with the super in-depth nature of going beat by beat, but rather by having a spoiler wall before we talk about anything super exciting and detailed about the story. So folks can listen to this first part, and if they want to then stop it and then come back to it after they finish the game, you can most certainly do that. So,
and there will be a there will be a little musical break, kind of like at the end of the WAF generalities, to signify the musical or the spoiler wall. Also, us telling you that this will be the spoiler wall.
I was going to say I will believe you, Cole. We will not go through all of the same creation notes and stuff that we did on the first one, because obviously this is just the second entry in the series. However, there are a few things to note about the production on this game. So first off, it was developed by Capcom, released in 2006 in Japan, 2007 in US and Europe. And Shu Takumi, the guy who created this, his boss told him that Phoenix Wright needed to be a trilogy after he had finished the first game. And so that's how this game and the third game in the series came about. Originally, Edgeworth was supposed to be the prosecutor in all of the cases, but because he became such a popular character with everyone after the first game, they decided that they didn't want to have him always face Phoenix Wright and keep continually losing, because then that kind of makes him less cool, I suppose. So they decided to come up with a new prosecutor for this game. And that's how we got to that.
Yeah, that's how we get Franziska Van Karma. So somebody else to come in, Van Karma, you will recognize that last name. She is the daughter of if you've played the first game, if you're listening to this, spoiler for that, 3, 2, 1. She is the daughter of the chief prosecutor who was Edgeworth's mentor. Tried to frame him for murder at the end of the first game. So she is here for revenge. And boy, you can tell that she was kind of a late addition, because she doesn't get really any character development, you know,
except for the fact that she has a whip. I don't know. That's her defining trait. She has a whip that somehow she can carry around in the courtroom because Phoenix Wright.
Straight up assault.
And she can straight up whip people, including the judge.
Yeah, just straight up assaulting people. And I'm convinced that they're like, hey, well, like, we're gonna give her a weapon because this is the entry that adds the health system. You know, prior, like, but, you know, before the HD updates, you know, you had like hearts, you lost hearts if you got a penalty and you had three of them, etc. It was changed into a meter for the HD remaster to fit the trilogy overall. The stuff that they do with the health penalties in this is wild. And I think giving her the whip was like, here you go. It's tough. No more Mr. Nice prosecutor or judge.
Yeah, and the other main mechanic that they added in this game was the psych lock.
Yes.
So we will talk a little bit more about that. Well, do you want to do it now or later?
It doesn't
really matter.
Yeah, I didn't mean to get into too much stuff there. I was just I jumped the gun offering my theory about Franziska von Karma having the whip.
Well, the Cyclocks are basically the only new thing gameplay wise, really, mm-hmm. for this.
Yeah.
And they basically, Maya Fey, the spiritualist slash assistant of Phoenix Wright, mm-hmm. gives him a Magatama, which is a little, looks like a comma. Looking thing.
Yeah, it's like a gem amulet.
It's imbued with magical power, and that is something that Phoenix uses in order to see these Cyclocks, which are manifestations of just how guarded each character that's hiding something from him is. And so there's multiple locks on people depending upon, you know, how guarded they are, and, you know, those have to be broken by presenting to them a certain piece of evidence that will, you know, like, just unlock everything, and then they just break down, and that you know, drops their guard.
Yeah.
So oftentimes you will run into the Cyclocks in the game, and then you haven't found the piece of evidence yet. You have to go find that piece of evidence, or sometimes multiple pieces of evidence, in order to go back to that witness and get them to uncover the truth.
Yeah, I think that adding this was a really canny thing to do, because this takes, you know, one of our complaints about the original game is that the investigation sections were pretty dry, you know, relatively linear. You were just looking for the thing, and then it went to the next, went to the next day. You know, once you talk to everybody, you were gone. This brings a little bit of the trial into the investigation sections, or at least some of the stuff that's interesting about the trial, you know, helping you kind of develop some of your own conclusions in a confrontational way, in a way that will unlock more truth and add more things to your court record to use during a case.
Yeah. And also, if you present the wrong evidence to this person to try to break their Cyclock, then you end up receiving a penalty. And if that bar gets totally depleted, then, you know, you have to completely restart the whole engagement with that witness.
Yes. Yeah. So. And successfully completing all the Cyclocks, I think, is the primary way that your health bar is replenished, is through this, as opposed to being replenished at the end of a trial section.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So, we had talked about the localization last time. Now, and we were talking about how wackadoodle it really kind of was. But with this game, the localization that they did in the first game was very well respected. People really liked that localization, except it made a lot of changes, like, make, you know, originally saying, oh, well, this game is taking place in LA and stuff like that, that really complicated things when they got to this installment. And then there's places that the characters have to travel to that are very, very obviously, you cannot pass that off as a burger, like that kind of a
eat your burgers, Phoenix.
Yeah. So then what they basically decided is that this is an alternate universe. It takes place in an alternate universe where anti-Japanese laws weren't passed, mm-hmm. and anti-Japanese sentiments weren't powerful, and where Japanese culture was doing just fine and flourishing.
Yeah.
So, but they also, of course, had to leave some of the stuff alone, as they did in the first game. Like, the Japanese justice system remained there, because otherwise you'd have to completely overhaul how the game itself works.
There's a moment in the last case where somebody is reluctant to testify because they're afraid of incriminating themselves, and they say, "Oh, there's a law that says I don't have to testify if it will, you know, result in me, you know, being charged with something." I was like, what? and feeding, yeah. You know, first off, yeah. A law. Okay, cool. Second off, Phoenix Wright says, wait a minute, somebody wouldn't just think to claim the fifth out of nowhere. As an American, man, it's my goddamn right to claim the fifth. I do it at the gas pump when it asks me if I want a receipt. Fuck no. How dare you?
Oh yeah. So they still kept the Japanese justice system, and then things that are related to the Fae clan, which are all of the mediums in the game, those mm-hmm. things, like they can't pass any of that off as being staunchly American. There's no. Nothing American about it. So they left all of that alone, but mm-hmm. they still kept the weird name changes for foods and things, just because at the time people did not broadly know what this or that Japanese food was.
Yeah.
Like, they just burgers. Sure.
It was the middle of, you know, it was the middle of the 2000s. Like, sushi was still kind of a bit of a joke in a lot of the country at that point. And if you said, you know, said like, oh, onigiri, I have no idea what that is. Okay. So burgers, why not?
Well, see, like that just seems super foreign to me, because I was such an otaku during that period of mm-hmm. time that, like, I'm like, what do you mean people don't know what that is?
Yeah, you know, and I've been playing so many kind of like Japanese themed games. Like, you know, I grew up playing Legend of the Mystical Ninja on the SNES, and you stop into, you know, sushi shops all the time, and just like, oh yeah. Onigiri, there we go. It's those things they call donuts on Pokemon. It's funny, you know. Like, yeah. So, you know, I like the food stuff is weird, but like, given the justification that they give for like why the West Coast would be like this, I just kind of saw Kurain Village and Maya's kind of whole clan. It's like here in the Midwest, we have an Amish enclave, right? It's an older religion and lifestyle, and it's reclusive, but they still interact with the regular world, you know, to, mm-hmm. you know, certain degrees. Right. So I saw that as analogous, and it doesn't really bother me at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it didn't bother me either. Like, I didn't think about it too hard, but that's because it's Phoenix Wright, and I don't think about anything too hard in Phoenix Wright, because a lot of everything is so bonkers that it's like, who's analyzing this really hard? Oh yeah, lots of people apparently. I'm not one of those, so you know, I can be spared from that. Something that I think is funny to me is that it was specifically stated that localizing Mo the Clown in this game was very challenging, and I'm like, Mo is probably the most infamous character from this game.
No, oh, it's terrible. I would have had trouble doing it, because it would have been an ethical concern. It would break the game developer's version of the Hippocratic Oath. Like, this is a fucking crime that is being committed right here. I need to, like, I would be an accessory if I thought up puns for this thing. And it does what mechanically? He does what happens when you press him?
yeah. Yeah, it's a lot. So I will say that where the infamous clown Mo appears in the game is probably the nadir of anything with the Phoenix Wright name on it that I have ever encountered thus far. So
it's comforting to know you've seen the worst. And like, the later games 5 and 6 get pretty spotty, you know, at points, uh-huh. but like, not nothing like this. Yeah.
Okay. Well, if I can tolerate this and get through to the other side, then that's good to know that I can get through the other ones.
Yeah.
Play the Great Ace Attorney Adventures. Those are great.
I want to.
Those are absolutely. Yeah. They're wonderful. You should play them. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk about the reception of this game, however.
Let's do it. Yeah.
So Metacritic scores this at a 76 out of 100. Generally favorable reviews. People like Ace Attorney. Surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. This one quote by John Walker of Eurogamer made me giggle. It was the most joyfully daft fun imaginable. And, you know, I think that's very, very well suited as a succinct way of talking about what's fun about this game. Mm-hmm. It's yeah, that's it. That's the vibe.
Yeah,
that's what you're in for.
Joyfully daft is a good way to put it, and also that is probably the most Eurogamer sentence I've ever seen.
Right.
Other than if somebody said, "Isometric platformers are an integral part of my childhood."
Oh man! But what about Landstalker? I played Landstalker. Well, anyway, okay. Anyway,
Landstalker's from my childhood, so therefore it's good and gets a pass.
No. Anyway, so things that were considered to be difficult about this game. Well, first off, the Cyclops were almost unanimously what everybody liked most about this game. Yeah. So that was a solid addition. Mm-hmm. And of course, the music was very well thought of, still thought of very wonderfully. People did not like that Capcom was reusing the animations from the first game because it felt like they're just recycling assets and stuff.
Yeah.
Because like they not that way it was easier for them to just pop out another one. You know, they don't have to, at least for the recurring characters, they don't have to make new sprites.
Yeah.
For me, it felt like, well, I mean, this is just more of exactly the same thing. What were you looking for? You know, like, you know, I don't mind that they have the same sprites. It's meant to be familiar. It's a second installment in a series, so mm-hmm. I mean that didn't bother me, but I don't know.
No, I fall on the same side of that too. I'm really resistant to anybody trying to pull the consumer rights, you know, greedy dev, lazy dev kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, doesn't matter to me. You know, like the Kunio Kun games are largely good, and they only could have made as many of them and also given them the cohesive vibe that they have if they didn't reuse a shit ton of assets. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
And that's another thing, too, that the Phoenix Wright games feel cohesive and feel like they just pick up off after the, you know, where the other one left off, more or less. They don't feel like it's like more day in the life, you know, episodes that you're getting with mm-hmm. each installment. It doesn't feel like, oh, this is a brand new thing and they've upgraded everything and changed it to 3D and whatever. I mean, like, yes, that happens eventually, but yeah. You know.
Yeah, you know, I'm you know, when I'm playing a Phoenix Wright game, what I'm there for is for the fun comic book mysteries, you know, and the twists and turns and the drama of the courtroom scenes. I'm not necessarily like sitting there with calipers saying they're exactly this many pixels between the eyes here. They did nothing to it. It's like, no, I'm not sitting there with an adding machine trying to add up and say, well, they made this cheaply. Like that doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, this, I will agree though, that there, the thing that was considered to be most frustrating about this particular game was how sometimes it would require very, very specific evidence to be presented, and things that you might think are reasonable things to present are not what the game wanted, and so you get a penalty from that. But then if you get a correct answer, it doesn't replenish your bar or anything. You just mm-hmm. have to shuffle on down the road.
Yeah.
So
the health system is way too punishing, and mm-hmm. that level of like specificity that it's asking for, I think, is a little bit of a result of them getting a little bit too granular with you needing to like walk through every single step of an argument to it. So like I would present something, but that's because I was like thinking a couple steps ahead of it or overthinking it. And it's like, no, you can't present that because there were like three steps on the way to that argument, even though this would have answered that same question.
That is about all that I've got for just kind of generalities about this. We kind of covered the whole IP and all of that on the first episode of Phoenix Wright. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think so. So I think this,
move in?
I think we are. This is the spoiler wall. You're going to hear some music and we're going to be back on the other side talking about particular cases. Let's get started talking about case number one. which starts, I mean, the opening of this game, like, we have Phoenix having a nightmare and then getting bonked on his head, and like Gilligan before him, he loses all of his memories, and thus we must learn the mechanics of the game for the second time along with him.
With the same prosecutor as from the first game. Oh. Winston Payne is back.
he's back for another bite of the apple.
I was so happy to see him back again because he was so funky in the first game that I was pleased when here he is again and he's like, oh God.
The progressive degradation of Winston Payne over the course of the series is so good.
I will believe you. I have played Phoenix Wright 1 and 2 as of the recording of this, and then the Great Ace Attorney Adventures, and I saw his ancestor in that one. It was very good. It was so good. I was so happy to see him there too.
He's one of the more one of the more charming transitions to 3D that they do.
Oh, for sure. I loved it.
This is a murder because they're all murders, right? The victim is one Dustin Prince, and the defendant is Maggie Bird. She is a police, or she's a good, wait a minute, like a junior police person, right?
Yes,
yeah.
She is. And her boyfriend, who is the victim, is also a police officer. So, what happens is they find him on the bottom of like a hill area with a broken neck sustained from having fallen off said hill.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who they all assume did it is Maggie Bird.
Mm-hmm.
But there's even a witness who says, oh yeah, I saw her doing whatever. And so that's kind of like how this started out. And of course she didn't do it. So she's got her own story to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. So Wellington story, obviously Wellington did it. He's going to just, man, it's so transparent who's the villain in some of these.
Oh, for sure.
Oh yeah. He's like a preppy college student kind of guy, right?
That's what he tries to pass himself off as. And he's got like this scarf and like, you know, the long front bangs and stuff and, mm-hmm. you know, the gleaming teeth kind of thing going for him.
There was a meetup, right? Maggie had lost her phone because kind of her characterization is that she's kind of flighty, right?
She found a phone.
Oh, right.
Is what it was. She found a phone and then ended up trying to figure out like whose phone is this, ends up figuring out whose phone it is. It tells them, okay, you know, I will return this phone to you at this park at 6 p.m. So Wellington went there and thought, okay, I'm just going to go get my phone. It's cool. This phone, he's a crook. Two-timing terrible crook guy.
He
stores all of his like clients or whatever in his phone. So he needs his phone, but it's also incriminating evidence.
Yeah.
Well, when he rolls up on Maggie around the time that he's supposed to meet her, he sees her boyfriend, who is a cop, and in his cop uniform. So then he jumps to a conclusion that she called the cops on him. If he hadn't freaked out, he could have just gotten his phone and moved on down the road, but instead it drives him to murder.
Yeah.
So,
and he's the one who sets it up. So Dustin goes over the edge. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and then he makes it look like, Dustin, like wrote Maggie's name, in the sand next to his body, you know, with his, with his last dying energy, you know, just real, just real kind of cliche stuff trying to frame her up.
How many times is this? You know, I should actually start making a list of how many times that happens in the series, because that happened in the first game too.
It did.
Yeah. It's like either that or it's just a really, really common thought. Okay. Yeah. Sure. This is definitely
it's a real common thing. You know? It happens in Danganronpa 1 as well. With the first victim,
no, I don't remember remember. I blotted it out of my head.
Right, that's the one you don't like. Yeah. No, it happens there, and they do something really clever where it's one thing upside down, and it's another thing. They worked out the translation of it pretty well, where it worked in English characters too. But yeah, he sets this up, and what ends up getting him getting him trapped is the fact that his glasses were under the body, and that so Wellington's glasses were under Dustin's body, and that couldn't have happened unless he was the one responsible for it.
Well, there's that, and when he wrote the name, I think they misspelled Maggie's name.
Yes,
as well.
Maggie instead of Y. Yeah,
like the 1-2 punch is the glasses are underneath there, and he's like, well, I dropped them beforehand or something. Mm-hmm. And you know, there wasn't a way to prove that, but he said Phoenix was like, oh, wait, hey Maya, call my phone. And what had happened was that Wellington snatched up a phone after he smacked Phoenix in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And that phone happened to be Phoenix's phone. He yep. thought it was, you know, the phone, his incriminating evidence phone, but it wasn't. So
yeah, he's got a real this guy has a real problem taking drastic actions based on snap perceptions, let's say. He could have saved himself a lot of trouble, because yeah, he was definitely the guy who gave Phoenix the Gilligan bonk.
Yeah, he did that, and you know, since he grabbed the phone thinking it was his own phone, he had it in his pocket. So when Maya called it, mm-hmm. you know, the phone in his pocket rang, and they're like, "Well, how could he, you know, how could he have the, you know, how could that call that unless that's my phone, and how would it be my phone unless you bonked me?"
Yeah.
Why would you bonk me? Because you think it's your phone that I've mm-hmm. got in my hand.
You know? And law, we call that mens rea. Yeah. consciousness of guilt. Yeah. So he didn't just bonk Phoenix in the head. He bonked him with a fire extinguisher.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man. It's a pretty simple case that has a few, you know, really familiar kind of devices, obviously framing up by writing the name next to the body, the glasses being in a position where they couldn't because of the order of events. I think it's a real weird assumption that they make that somebody will be jumping right into this without having played the first one.
Yeah, I don't know why somebody would do that, but I mean, at the same time, I would assume that Capcom probably just was like, well, you don't know who's going to play it or how long it might have been since they played the first one. You just need to make sure that they just know what they're doing.
Yes.
I don't know.
You know, they didn't want to do lockout like right away. Mm-hmm. I think it would stick out a little bit less to me if they didn't go with the amnesia kind of angle to it. Although they worked it in pretty nice as making it part of the kind of coup de grace.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how it manifests itself in the third game, because mm-hmm. I have waited to play that until after we talked about this one.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how it plays out in the third game, but hopefully if they keep doing tutorials, they do not do the same trick over and over again.
They don't. It's more graceful kind of in future ones. I think also, you know, like we're at like 3, 4, 5, 6. It's pretty safe to assume that you know what's going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like case two much better. You know, we're training wheels off. You know, case one is it's really short. You know, it's literally just the trial segments. Case two is the first one that has the investigations and really introduces you to the Magatama as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And poor Maya.
Yeah,
she keeps on being implicated.
Yeah, she is now defendant again, charged for murder again, and Phoenix is again trying to defend her.
Mm-hmm. So what's the setup for this? How do they end up in Kurain?
So Maya is from the village of Kurain, and she's going back there because she is doing some more training or something, isn't it? And then Phoenix is going to visit her in Corraine.
Yes.
So, you know, she's gone off to do her training because she's neglected it, and she feels bad about the waning of her spiritual power. So she goes back mm-hmm. home to work on it.
Yeah.
And Phoenix rolls up there.
Mm-hmm.
And Phoenix is visited by a surgeon called Turner Gray. And so, like, it was there was a scandal at Turner Gray's clinic.
Yeah.
Where several patients died due to malpractice. And so there were all these rumors about what was happening with that. The blame was placed on a young nurse that was working at that office. But then that same nurse died a year ago, as of the date of this visit, in a car wreck. And rumors started to spread that Turner Gray had killed her.
Yeah.
So Gray wanted to summon the spirit of that nurse to figure out what really happened and have his name cleared. So Maya is still in training and would only agree to do that if Phoenix came along for the ride. And that's when they went to Corraine.
Yes. There we go. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I had to backtrack and mm-hmm. kind of work through it again.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So it's, we're brought up there and we're introduced to a couple of different pieces, a couple of different parts of Maya's kind of extended family. You know, obviously she had her sister, she had Mia, but she's gone. But mm-hmm. she also has a niece named Pearl, who is cute as a button, although I think we spend a little bit too much time with her, honestly. I'd rather mm-hmm. spend time with Maya so she gets time to develop. And we're also introduced to Pearl's mother, who is Morgan mm-hmm. Faye. Yeah. Which is a good way to which it's a very good way to indicate that she is a villain is to give her that name. Yeah.
Right. And then of course also she's just very uptight and traditional and whatever, and like yeah. usually if somebody is like that and they're uptight and traditional, like there's usually something fishy going on with them.
Yeah.
At least in these kinds of games it feels like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. But she is really protective of Pearl and kind of rules her life and her training with an iron fist, because she sees like room for her side of the family to become ascendant within the Fae clan.
Especially since Pearl is extremely gifted mm-hmm. and she doesn't feel that it is right that Maya is the successor of the Corraine people.
Yeah.
When, like the Fae clan in Corraine, when her daughter is younger and more talented in the mediumship. So.
And Morgan is up to no good. You know, she has a hand in this, though the actual murder itself ends up being a more complicated story related to mistaken identity and revenge against Turner Gray for those deaths way back when. So you have to, again, like in the first game, you end up solving a couple of different mysteries within this case.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, I will pause for just a second and say, listeners, I played this game a while ago, so
yeah.
Apologies for my little bit of a confusion right at the start there. Like, wait, why was he there? Wait a minute. Let me think. Yeah. Yeah, what was that? What was the reason?
It was a visit and moral support. But what ends up happening is during the channeling, supposedly the spirit of Mimi Miney is taking her over and shoots him with his own gun, is what it is made to appear. After a bit of a struggle here and figuring out how the real killer could have gotten into the sealed room. So not only are we solving a background mystery, but we're also solving a locked room mystery.
Mm-hmm. And what's fun about that is we also have recurring character Lotta Hart, the photographer, self-styled journalist lady.
Yep.
So she's back poking around and is taking photos that are used in the whole investigation.
I had completely forgotten about how important she was to these games. Like she like throughout this, she kind of ends up being almost like an accessory to Gumshoe, to a certain degree. She just, whenever we need a photo, she is here to provide it, under the, mm-hmm. under the flimsiest possible pretext. And that's great.
So, it's right around this time when Phoenix is trying to figure out what's going on, you know, because the door is open. Here is Maya looking possessed. And then Morgan shoos everybody out. And then, you know, Maya is taken to a room to recover. And Phoenix is trying to figure out what's going on. Well, when Maya comes to, she tells him about a dream that she had. And also says, oh, this Magatama, let me give this to you. Pearl's going to help you figure out how to use this thing. She can help do something with this. So he talks to Pearl and she charges it magically with her essence or mediumship or whatever. I don't know exactly how that works. But now he's able to find the Cyclocks. And the first time he comes across these is on Eeny Meeny, who is Mimi Meeny's sister.
Yep. And she is presented. I don't know of another way to say this in a less problematic way. She is presented like the archetype here is a ditz, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She has kind of a airhead bubbly kind of speech patterning and it makes it sound like, oh, was that what it was? Okay. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I got it confused because of something on TV. You know, that kind of flippant kind of attitude about everything.
Mm-hmm. And it just real circuitous. It ends up being, you know, because she's the culprit. She actually did all of this and organized everything. But it ends up being really canny obfuscation is what she's doing with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we figure out all the details of that, we get our first meeting with Franziska von Karma. She has come from America, and she threatens Phoenix upon first sight for the name of von Karma. So,
yeah, no, she's going to she is going to pull the name from the gutter while also continuing her just undefeated record. As a prosecutor, let's say, that's going to be put down. She's a prodigy. So she's very cocky enough to think that she can whip a judge.
Yeah. Well, she gets away with it countlessly. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess so. It works for her, but it's anime. So I can't tell how old she's supposed to be, but she is made to sound as if she is considerably younger. Because prodigy, like a young prodigy upstart, you know, kind of thing. I do not know how old she is, but
I think in the court record it says that she's 18.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and then, but Phoenix is like 22, 23 or something.
Oh, yeah. Right? Everything is crazy town.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Well, anyway, moving right along. One thing that happens when you're trying to unravel the Cyclocks of Eeny Meeny is behind her, inexplicably, a big box just appears and it drives you nuts, but you can't go look at the box because Eeny Meeny is in the room and won't let you. Yeah. So it takes some kind of distraction. I don't remember what happens to get her out of the room. I honestly do not remember, but during the investigation, while you're trying to figure out what's going on, you somehow manage to get her out of the room. And then you sneak in there long enough to check out the inside of the box. And that's what starts you getting the idea of what's going on.
Yeah, because you get traces that there was somebody inside of it. So this was...
And there's some spare clothes and that happens to be like a medium outfit that looks exactly like Maya's. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So it's about this point that we start getting into the trial, I believe, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, something that is a question and something that I think is really cool about this case. And as a bit of a theme throughout the entire game is like, okay, in this situation, if Maya was possessed by the ghost of this vengeful woman, is she still culpable under our legal system? You know, mm-hmm. she would have been the tool for this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so like as a part of trying to figure out how to answer that question, we learn kind of some of the mechanics about like what happens here. We know that the spirit mediums change appearance when they are inhabited.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Stuff like that. So I think that's really interesting. Like most of these cases end up being swerves from like direct culpability in certain ways. I think it's interesting to try to answer that question for Maya. And one of the things that you learn here ultimately ends up being the thing that unravels the case for you.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, for sure. So do we want to talk about like how it all went down? Because I do not remember all the back and forth in the courtroom.
Yeah. let's start at the end and kind of talk about some of the leaps that you take there. Because this is a whole big like switcheroo basically that ends up happening.
Yes, because eeny meeny is actually meeny meeny nurse from way back when.
Yep.
Who has undergone extensive plastic surgery.
Yes.
So when she figures out that Dr. Gray is still trying to, you know, meddle with her family, she just gets frustrated and is like, you already pinned all this on me and all this mm-hmm. other stuff. And
killed you know, my she sister. Goes,
mm-hmm, yeah, yeah. Killed my sister, did all this other stuff. I am, you know, going to take care of you myself. Yeah. And that's her very understandable reasoning for wanting to go after this guy.
She got her face rearranged at the hottie clinic.
Yeah.
This extended scene that I think they think is way funnier than it actually is with the patient and the doctors in the scrubs. Kind of the, yeah, it didn't work for me.
Grabby, gross doctor man.
Yep.
Slaboring over anything female, yep. literally anything. In the Japanese version, his grabby hands are in relation to Pearl.
Oh, fun.
Yay. Things I didn't want to know that I found out while researching for this show.
there's other stuff that happens with Pearl that ends up being pretty.
Yeah.
I don't care for that. We'll talk about it when we get there. But
we'll talk about it when we get there. So anyway, Eeny. Or a Mimi, whatever, that one, mm-hmm. the culprit was able to get some clothes that look like Maya's clothes. And before the summoning happened, she slunk in there and hid herself in that big box that popped up in that room that you saw.
Mm-hmm.
Then as soon as Maya started doing the summoning, she jumped out and knocked Maya out mm-hmm. and then stabbed at Dr. Gray.
Yeah.
And she thought he died when she stabbed him.
Mm-hmm.
Only that's not what happened. He actually was still alive and had a gun and shot at her.
Mm-hmm.
And so during that struggle, he shot and missed, hitting the box and also Maya's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And because as part of the scheme, Maya was put in the box that Eeny came out of.
Yeah.
You know,
so there wouldn't be two Mayas if people looked in.
Yeah, 100%. It would look like, you know, Maya had been possessed by the spirit of the vengeful ghost mm-hmm. and all of that. So anyway, the bullet went through Maya's clothing in the box. And because, you know, he was already stabbed in the chest,
mm-hmm.
she was able to wrestle the gun away from him. And then she shot him in the head.
Yes.
So when the door was opened, she looks like not Maya, but mm-hmm. everybody's like, oh, she's possessed. And then Morgan shoos everybody out and then allows the switcheroo to happen back where, you know, Maya is out of the box and Eeny Meeny or Mimi Meeny, whatever you want to call her, is in the box. And they just like smear blood all over Maya and go from there, and then just frame her for it.
Yeah. So it was a locked room mystery up until Morgan got in there and, you know, with collusion and in the confusion, helped set up the switches again to frame Maya so that to make room at the top of the fake land for Pearl. Right.
Yep. That was a crime of opportunity right there. Like, hey, this is a good setup. Let's roll with it.
let's do it. What helps unlock this, you know, say like, okay, it couldn't have been Maya because no spirit channeling actually happened. Because Maya had a dream. She was knocked out. You know, it's revealed. I think maybe Mia at this point possesses Pearl for the first time. But that's how we learned.
I did not like that.
I don't care for it at all. But she says like, yeah, no, the spirit mediums, when they're channeling somebody, they don't, you know, like they're gone. There is no, you know, dream that happens. So this happened with Maya when Mia took over her body. And Maya's 16, still gross, but whatever. But again, because of the body changing, you know, Mia is very busty. And when she took over Maya, she also manifested with large breasts and, you know, Mia's face and the beauty mark. When Mia takes over Pearl, this, I think, 8-year-old girl, something like that. Here we have her growing up to adult stature and having Mia's distinctive features, the large breasts and the beauty mark. I don't care for hyper sexy Pearl. That's a little
like
much.
Here, let's stuff an adult body into an 8-year-old's clothing, and you can see where that's going with the math, right?
Yes.
So
don't care for it one bit.
Nope.
It keeps happening throughout the game. I almost said it. At least it doesn't keep happening. No, I think it happens once per case. So.
Yeah, it happens. It happens rather regularly.
Yeah.
And also anytime Dr. Hottie or whatever pops back up again, now that I know that the hand gesture thing was meant for Pearl and that they switched it to be about one of the nurses instead in the English version.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that made it worse.
No, it's no good. No. But we get, we get Maya acquitted. It's pretty tragic. Like, you know, the actual culprit here, Eni or Mimi, I forget.
It's Mimi, masquerading as Eni.
Okay. There we go. She had reason to want revenge, and it's sympathetic. Like, that doctor wasn't a good person, but also, you know, that's not how this works, right?
Yeah.
So she's going to be carted off and executed, because that's what happens off camera at the end of each of these cases. Morgan, I believe, because she was an accomplice, I think she's going to be killed too.
I don't know. I don't remember
she's gone.
What happened. I know she's definitely punished in some form or fashion, but Pearl is not like, she's sad, but she's not like, my mother just got taken away to be killed. Yeah. So, but then again, it's this game. So, I mean, everything is Teflon. I mean,
nobody responds to anything appropriately. Let's see here. Last known status, incarcerated. Okay, so she was taken off to be in prison. But, like, that's Pearl's mom, you know, so that's why she ends up coming to live with Maya in Phoenix.
Yes.
And Phoenix's weird life, mirroring Professor Layton's, of just, all right, here's a young person, they're yours now.
Yeah. Let's just collect all the young people.
Yeah.
So then that's all for case two, and then we start off case three, Turnabout Big Top, which is, as we have mentioned, infamously bad.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those frustrating things, like anything that ends up being a little bit of a bit of common knowledge, like, you know, people who are, you know, moderately aware of Phoenix Wright will say like, oh yeah, the second game has that circus case. And everybody that I've talked to is like, oh yeah, that's trash. You know, just it's no good. I make myself frustrated because I go and take a look and then I find the people who defend it. It's like, I understand like the cool things that you're saying about this, like, the, you know, like, yes, the stuff that is gestured toward here with, you know, the fact that here is this, you know, tight-knit community of performers who are undone because the linchpin that kind of held everything together is taken away, you know, and like navigating that dynamic is cool. It's just not, it's not forefronted. And instead we get a bunch of like colorful, but very flat characters, or the, the incredibly obnoxious Mo the Clown.
Like, I don't, how long is this case versus the other ones? It felt to me like it was about 20 times longer than almost any of the other cases. It felt very long, and I don't know if it really was that long or if that was perception.
I'm still playing it, and not just from like moment when we agreed to do this a year ago. I'm still playing it from when I got this game in 2007. Yeah, it feels extremely long. There are also some just real preposterous like leaps in the actual facts of the case. There, you know how the JFK assassination had the magic bullet? This has the magic cape.
There's
a statue that, you know, the murder weapon is the statue that falls and hits the ringleader. It falls and, you know, knocks him out and kills him. And the ringleader is wearing a cape. And illogically, we even see this like frame by frame in a video that they show. As he falls down, the cape stays up in the air behind him and then just like whoop, catches on the statue in an illogical way that should not happen. That it, like, understanding that that is what happened and working toward it is unreasonable.
yeah. So the statue is of one Max Galactica, who's the star of the circus. And it's funny because I couldn't stand this guy.
Oh, he sucks.
But Dave liked him. Oh. I was like, why? Why do you like him? I just did not understand. But he's like, he's very excited. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. Okay. I don't know. Maybe it's because it looks kind of like an 80s hairband guy or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because he's got like, doesn't he have like a heart or something on his face?
Yeah. He's got like face decal kind of things going on. Like he's an illusionist. So he does like card tricks and stuff, you know, and big like stage magic kind of things. So he's done all up in like a playing card suit, kind of things. I wouldn't mind him so much. Like the joke of him, you know, his whole affect being put on to cover up the fact that he's, you know, like for like a down home, like Georgia kind of guy, you know, just like it shows you his real accent and is like a real thick Southern, you know, he's just a country boy who's made it big in show business. Right. That's fine. When he is in his Max Galactica persona, everything that he says takes five times as long as it should, because it is just laden with puffery.
Yeah. That is a very good way to put it, because he's very bombastic and he's very, I don't know, effervescent. Yeah. There's lots of multiplication of anything. Like it's not just one bubble. It's got to be a whole passel of bubbles, you know?
Yeah. So I think that adds a lot of time, you know, in addition to Mo's constant punning, Regina's obliviousness, you know, et cetera, and down the line. Max insists that he didn't do this, but there are ultimately two witnesses that saw him, you know, commit the murder by blunt force trauma on the back of the ringleader's head. The ringleader being, Russell Barry. This is the Barry Big Circus. Which, like, you just show up, like Phoenix and Maya and Pearl came here just as a fun thing to do, and the show got canceled because of the murder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But everybody saw Max Galactica do it, and this is saying something. Even, you know, even for this series, the sequence of events that happens for this that makes them think that is the case is implausible.
I forget completely, why did Russell Berry steal from Max Galactica the top hat and the cape and wear them?
So he did it to disguise himself as he was going out, because what got him into the courtyard where the murder happened was he found a note pinned to the wall that said, you know, to the killer, meet me here, so and so. He wanted to go in a disguise, so if people saw him, they wouldn't, you know, associate that if anything came out. I believe is the case. So it was flimsy, but it was a reason.
Well, because that just means that it's just going to implicate Max. Did he have it out for Max?
not in particular. I don't think so.
Well, didn't he, like, from everybody's like eyewitness accounts and stuff, Russell Berry was a very, very kind and sweet man. Yeah. So, like, I think it was he just felt like he was guilty. He felt guilty. Oh, no. It's because, okay, we got to back up and explain it from the beginning, the whole thing. So this one, like many of these other cases, really started a long, long time ago,
mm-hmm.
when there was an accident. This was several months before the case started. And there was an acrobat, Bat, who was mm-hmm. in love with Regina, Mr. Berry's daughter. And they would always kind of pass pranks back and forth between each other. Mm-hmm. And Bat tried to get Regina to go out with him and said, hey, if I can do one of your tricks, one of your stunts or something from the circus, if I can do that just as well as you can, then you have to go on a date with me, like an actual honest to God date.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's like, okay. But as usual, she wanted to play a prank. So she gave him her scarf and put pepper in it to make him sneeze, saying, okay, this scarf is like a luck token or whatever. And yeah. So he put it on and there was pepper in it. It didn't make him sneeze, but the problem here with the pepper is that Regina's a lion tamer. And so Bat was supposed to put his head in the mouth of the lion and do that, because that's, you know, the trick that Regina does that he can do too.
Yeah.
And the pepper makes the lion sneeze right as Bat's head goes into his mouth. And so he ended up so badly hurt that he ended up in a coma. And his brother, Acro, ended up getting injured as well and ending up in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And the lion is shot in the head by Russell Berry, the owner of the circus, because the lion, you know, not of its own will, but it did still, you know, injure two of his people.
Yeah.
So when he saw to the murderer, he thought that this was, about the lion.
Yeah. You know, everybody loved that lion. He loved that lion. You know, this is just a horrible tragedy, you know, begot of no ill intention at the beginning, but it, you know, permanently altered the lives of these two brothers. And Regina moved on pretty quickly because she's never known a life outside of the circus. And so everything is kind of a fantasy for her. I feel like I'm a boomer talking about millennials. Oh, you never been in the real world, Regina. Not everything is, you know, clown organs and trapeze men. No. So she has this, you know, she even responds to, like, she's not even taking the death of her father very hard, because, you know, he sheltered her so much and said, oh, people don't die, they just become stars, right? So
yeah.
You know, Bat going away, just the tragedy didn't really sink in. So, you know, Regina is just going on and moving on with her life. Falling in love with a ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah.
God, yeah. Oh man. Ben and Trillo end up not being a really important part of this, but that's another thing that ends up making this take forever. The shtick back and forth with Ben and Trillo. Ben is this really kind of shy, you know, kind of guy. The star of the show is the dummy. It'd be weird if it wasn't, if the dummy was the straight man. But she falls in love with the dummy, not aware that it is Ben. That it is Ben who is kind of controlling him, and you know. It goes as far as like Trillo arranging to propose, right?
It goes some places and it won't stop going. And there has to be like all these interruptions of Trillo beating up on Ben just constantly, and had them having arguments with each other.
Yep. It'd be fine if it was voiced. You know, or if it was like live action or like animated, but the fact that it's like tied to these loops and the text coming across, it just makes it take fucking forever.
yeah. So you've got a few people that you can kind of, you know, think, okay, this person might be who did it, because, for example, the ventriloquist doll Trillo is in love with Regina. Max Galactica, the defendant in this case, is actually affianced to Regina. So, like, you know, you might think, okay, well, maybe the ventriloquist did it, because, you know, they're fighting over Regina, and maybe he was trying to frame Max, you know, or something like that. But then it kind of swerves, and then it goes elsewhere instead. You end up finding out that the circus also has a monkey named Money, and that Money the monkey stole some kind of a trophy and brought it back to his trainer's room. Mm-hmm. The trainer happens to be Acro Bat's brother, the one who is in a wheelchair.
Yeah. So the trophy that was stolen was a bust of Max. You know, and it is the reason he took it was Max is holding these two handfuls of fanned out playing cards that are in platinum. What he wanted at the magician contest store. So that's why it ended up there. And that kind of takes us up to the day of the murder.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, it ends up that Acro is wanting to kill Regina, actually, because it was Regina's fault that Bat stuck his head in the lion's mouth and that the lion bit down on Bat in the first place.
Yeah.
So he put the letter into her pocket, and she saw it and goes, huh, well, I'm not a murderer. So she puts it up in the cafeteria and, you know, just pins it to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So meanwhile, Russell found it, you know, on the wall and was like, oh, that they're talking about me. And then that's how it ended up. This is how Acro ended up luring Russell instead of Regina to the place where he was going to do the deed.
Yeah. Out in the, out in the, oh gosh, the courtyard, after a scuffle happened, because Max and Trillo got in a fight, like a wine bottle was smashed, you know, again, more stuff kind of implicating Ben, and all of this here. So that ended the practice that they were doing. Russell goes out instead of Regina, and sees a box at the far end, and figures, okay, this must be where the evidence is. It's a very heavy box that was specially made for this, with handles on either end of it. So when he bent down to pick it up, his head would be in a particular place. And that's how Acro, who is disabled and cannot walk, was able to know where his head would be, as he, you know, found the heaviest thing in Money Monkey's goodie pile to pick it up and attach it to a rope and drop it down and hit him and then pull the murder weapon back out. And this is what you know, so that this is where the cape gets attached. And this is what Mo the clown sees. I've alluded to what happens with when you cross-examine Mo the clown, because he's one of the primary witnesses here. So Mo is constantly trying to joke. He's got kind of a Fozzie the Bear kind of thing going on with him. You know, he's a failed comedian. He's a clown that can't make anybody laugh, but he very sweatily tries to make it happen anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And he is very prone to going off on tangents about how pathetic he is. You know, like, oh, my life is, you know, et cetera, or whatever. You get him up on the stand, and the judge very quickly loses patience with his whole attitude. And so what this does that is really, really inadvisable, because every other case in the entire series encourages you to press as much as possible, not just to learn more, but also you do that to reveal, you know, to change statements, right? To reveal something that you can contradiction to, right? Present evidence for. Here, if you press on the wrong thing, then it is instant death for you. It gets the case thrown out.
Yeah. See, they have something where you want to be careful about where you press in the Great Ace Attorney Adventures. However, it's not an instant death situation.
Yes. And I appreciate that, because something that ends up happening over the course of the series, you know, especially here in this trilogy, is that it does kind of train you, like, okay, the first thing that you do on seeing any testimony is to press as much as you can, right?
Mm-hmm.
Press everything. And anything that breaks you out of that pattern and makes you think more about, like, you know, what is going to yield me good data versus what is just going to be a bunch of noise is neat. Something that makes you think about it more. This is not the way to do it.
This is the ill-advised version of that, which is like, you know, like, oh, so Mo is so special and sensitive that you, like, you game over anytime you push him too much. Okay. And it's because, like, he snaps whenever you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just, like, he loses it. Isn't that what happens? Like, he just loses it whenever you do.
Oh, he tangents. Like, that's yeah. It makes it seem like he's the one who is doing it. And, like, oh, he's going to take his ball away and go home. It's the judge who you just, like, I can't stand this nonsense in my courtroom. It's like, dude, do you know how much nonsense I've seen in this courtroom?
Right? Oh, man.
Yeah. And so there's multiple testimonies. And I think you kind of cross-examine him on 2 days where this is a factor. And it is just the pits. This is also, like, this case starts introducing penalties that are not just like the two little pips off of the health bar. You get a couple of, like, make or break moments where if you choose the wrong option, then it's instant death. Or you get ones where it's like, you know, this would take away half of your health bar if you got this wrong. And so if you're riding, you know, anywhere below full health, this will effectively be instant death for you. Instant death is not good, especially when effectively the only penalty for it is reload from whenever you last saved.
Yeah.
And then try it again. It's just a time and annoyance tax, and it's not a good use of this system.
Yeah, I agree with that. But so one more thing I didn't mention is the police were trying to figure out where the statue that was used, the murder weapon, where that came from. And the murder weapon was stashed in the only place that there was to hide it for Acro, in his own wheelchair underneath his blanket.
Everybody's aghast when you suggest that we need to look at the wheelchair properly.
Yeah.
I might add, but
yeah.
Oh,
for sure.
Yeah.
But the one bright side to the end of this other than the fact that it's ending, it wraps up at some point, is that there's a little blip that shows Edgeworth in an airport reading a newspaper article about Francisca. And mm-hmm. he tells Gumshoe over the phone that he's going to be coming back.
Yes. So like up to this point, they had been trying to kind of make it seem like he had decided to kill himself after, mm-hmm. you know, like Phoenix, whenever Edgeworth is brought up, he says, you know, don't talk to him, not about what happened. It's implied that there is some great tragedy and that's why he is not in the picture anymore. You know, at one point they it even says like, oh, he just one day up and quit and left a note on his desk that says, I choose death. And that was never that was never borne out. Like that was just a shitty thing for him to do. So learning that Edgeworth is alive and is going to be back in the picture is actually really good, because Edgeworth and Phoenix are like the necessary, you know, the necessary foils to each other, I think.
Yeah, I will say I am not a Francisca von Karma fan. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, although one thing that's very funny to me is, okay, it's a slight tangent. Francisca always says like Mr. Phoenix Wright and uses his whole name every mm-hmm. time. And I didn't realize that I thought that was funny until I realized that someone that I work with, who's a teammate of mine at my job, always uses everyone's first and last name together. Always.
Is he trying to cultivate an angry or disappointed parent vibe?
No, she doesn't. She doesn't do that. I don't know why she does it that way.
I'm sure she has a reason.
Like, say for example, one of the people that she was referring to has like a very, very specific name that I've never heard anywhere else before. Like, mm-hmm. just the first name would do. You don't have to clarify. There's no other ones. There's no other ones that are in reference here. Mm-hmm. I've never come across another one. You don't need to give me the first and last name, but she does it all the time. It's like by force of habit. And I don't know if it's just because, you know, there's a lot of people in the industry that have similar names. I mean, we've talked before about the many, many Daves that there are, things like that. So maybe she's running up on the Legion of Daves.
Oh no, the Dave Legion got her.
That's my tangent. I'm done with that now. We can move on to case four unless you have anything else to say about case three.
So I wanted to ask you, Acro's presentation, we didn't really allude to this, but he is always presented as being a completely serene, at one with everything, you know, not necessarily like outwardly even depressed or bummed out about the fact that he has a disability, to the point where, like, when he is testifying, he testifies with birds nesting on him, or not nesting. Yeah. That'd be weird. Perching on him, right?
Perching on him. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's coded as kind of an indigenous person. That's not what I'm especially concerned about, but like his very calm affect. And even when, you know, the noose tightens on him, he doesn't do the freak out at the end of it. It seems like they're going especially out of their way to make it to try and justify and say that, like, yes, he actually, like, you know, you should feel bad that this person got caught for doing this. Did you run it? Like, did that clang for you? Like the them trying to say, like, you know, Acro got a raw deal, kind of with the way it was coming across.
Well, they kind of make it feel more like that because he says, you know, I loved Russell Berry like a father and I didn't mean to kill him.
Yes.
But I just couldn't let it go that Regina did this to Bat, my brother, and then is just flippant and doesn't even, you know, doesn't care, mm-hmm. you know, and he accepts his fate and he kind of just goes on with it and just, you know, like he's, I think, the only person that has not freaked out, you mm-hmm. know? but I don't know. I like the fact that they have this personality, especially when there's so many over the top, way too loud characters in this particular case.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that was part of their way of trying to make this one especially memorable. But yeah, I think, you know, they're trying to pull your heartstrings a little bit because, you know, he's got the birds on him just perching happily. And, you know, everybody was scandalized when you wanted to look at the wheelchair. Like, mm-hmm. why would you do that to him? You know, yeah. like make you feel bad for doing your job, you know, kind right. of thing. So, and that's kind of a setup for what they end up doing to you in the fourth case. So that's a good mention.
We do end up in case four with some just real re-traumatizing of a very vulnerable person.
Yeah.
Oh, but case four, farewell, my turnabout, is what this is. It takes place. We get our cast of characters associated with the Samurai Children's television show scene back here. It's at the kind of the Grand Prix, like the big award ceremony for all of these. Like, what would be the name for these kind of shows? Like samurai shows aimed at kids?
I don't know, because they're not Sentai shows. I don't know what they would be referred to as. I'm sure there's a name for it. Mm-hmm. I have never watched enough or been around enough of them to know.
Yeah.
Know the name of that particular type of media.
Yeah. But it's this big gala award ceremony at the Gatewater Hotel. And the ceremony does not go on because one of the people who is going to be honored, Juan Corita, aka the Jammin Ninja. Yeah, was killed. He was killed in his hotel room. And the suspect, the person who all of the evidence is pointing at, is his professional rival, Matt Ungard, who plays the Nickel Samurai, kind of the successor to the Steel Samurai from the first game.
Mm-hmm. And because you've got something related to these type of folks, you got Wendy Old Bag popping back up in here. And because we just can't get enough of him, Director Hottie pops up in here too.
Yep. Don't care for that.
And Will Powers comes back from the first game. The man who is her suit that they keep on saying is terribly ugly. Like, he just has some sideburns. Like, I don't understand.
He looks like Wolverine, not Freddy Krueger. Chill out.
Right.
No. Oh man, yeah. So we're getting lots of folks back. We're getting a lot of heart here too. You know, she's kind of taken on gone back to photography and is doing like paparazzi kind of here around the scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you go through and you talk to Matt at the detention center, he says that he was sleeping in his room when the murder took place. And then, you know, Phoenix is like, well, weren't you supposed to have been preparing for the press conference? Mm-hmm. And he claimed he didn't know anything about it. So,
yeah,
you know, because he said he didn't have anything to announce or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, he sounds fishy from the start. And so, like, you know, you're used to always being with the innocent, you know, client, but
yeah,
everything seems to be pointing to this guy right from the start.
Suspiciously so. Like, you know, Gumshoe at this point is real kind of buddy with you. You know, he's willing mm-hmm. to help you out as opposed to being kind of a brick wall in the first game. You're kind of the only person he interacts with who is not either trying to flay him alive or cut his salary down to where he is even further in poverty. But he even says, like, yeah, this is like suspiciously arrayed against the culprit here, or the person who we think is the culprit, the suspect. There we go. That's the word for that. We haven't even taken on the case yet. Like, at one point, Maya says, hey, I'm going to step away for a moment. And she does. And then she is not around. for a while, and something that drives you to take the case, to try and convince Matt on guard to, you know, to hire you on, is the fact that you, somebody hands you a like little walkie-talkie receiver, and somebody has taken Maya hostage, saying mm-hmm. that if you, you know, do not get Matt a complete acquittal on the first day of the trial, then Maya, Maya Fey is dead.
And then, of course, once Phoenix takes Matt on as a client and then goes to the hotel and starts to investigate, he runs up on three, not just one, but three people who have Cyclops.
Yep.
It's Matt's manager, Adrian Andrews, and mm-hmm. then also Lotta Hart and Wendy Oldbag. All of them have Cyclops on them.
I love that Wendy Oldbag, like, she has four of them. Like, that's serious business. Right? You know, it makes you think, oh, she's really hiding something. No, mm-hmm. she's just that stubborn. That goes away if you bring her an autograph from Juan Carita.
Yeah.
Like, she's just a huge fan of the murder victim here. She mm-hmm. she hated Matt on guard because he's yep. you know, like a real slick Hollywood type. Yeah.
Yep. And she always kind of like roots for the underdog guy, it mm-hmm. seems like. Yeah. So
yeah. Lotta is a little bit cagey because she has some like her she's trying to basically protect her source and obfuscate like why she is here. Like it seems like, and she's trying to play it off like she was just taking pictures of the Steel Samurai and then she lost her camera, but she was actually here investigating the real important person here, who is Adrian, the Matt Ongard's manager. You know, it was in the tabloids that the manager Adrian was having a steamy affair with Juan Carita. And so that makes her a prime suspect. However, those Cyclops have to do with some actual psychological problems that Adrian has that ultimately end up working in to the case itself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and one thing I forgot to mention, too, and this is important, is that when you're in the detention center, Pearl suggests that you use the Magatama and check Matt for Cyclops, since we're talking about Cyclops. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have any. Right. And he says, I didn't kill anyone, and there's not like a lie detector beep beep boop or anything like that. So like, you know, he's not hiding that. You know, he doesn't have any Cyclops and everything. So yeah. You know, that's why you are willing to extend the benefit of the doubt to him and go forward with all of this despite the kidnapping and all of the rest. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and you know, just like, yeah, okay, like it's it seems pretty good. He literally can't lie to me, so we'll take him on. We believe in the client, right? And that ends up being a little like one of the threads here too, like that Edgeworth specifically tries to play up, which is when he confronts Phoenix, is like, you know, you need to think about what it actually means to be a defense attorney. Right. You know, you handed my ass to me and I needed to step away to think about, you know, is it my job to win cases, you know, and really consider like what my actual goal is here. You need to think about it for yourself. Right. And so mm-hmm. we end up here like Phoenix has every reason to be unethical in this and push for a win no matter what, when everything that we find constricts the noose on him and kind of is going to a point where you think it's going to be a choice between Maya and Matt, and it kind of is at certain, you know, like there are ways that this can fail, you know, and you get like bad endings and stuff, which is weird for this series.
Yeah. And also while he's talking to Phoenix, he's also mentioning a couple of important pieces of information that kind of tips Phoenix off for what to look at next.
Yeah.
The first is about Celeste, who is Juan's former manager, who had apparently killed herself, and Juan found the body, and it's suspected that he might have had like a suicide note or something like that that she had written. Yeah. Before she committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is just regarding Adrian. And Adrian was what, the understudy of Celeste, was
she, it? She was a protege. Yeah.
Yeah, protege. Mm-hmm. And she was very close to Celeste. And after Celeste died, actually attempted suicide herself.
Yes. So there was a, you know, I love knowing what the kind of the trick here is. I love how he is very consciously trying to put these things out. Like he is doing his own frame up on Adrian.
Yeah. 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 I like that. And I really like the way that Edgeworth during the entirety of this last case is kind of mentoring Phoenix on what it means to be a defense attorney. Like, I mean, yes, he says you need to think about it, but he's also providing Phoenix some leads that he wouldn't have had otherwise, you know, which, you know, if he's really trying to, you know, win the case, he wouldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it it's great because I mean, yeah. No, he I mean, I know that you asked that as a joke. No, Miles has undergone some character development, which makes Phoenix's initial posture against him kind of baffling, given the way that the first game ended with them, you know, like it really just implied before they knew that they were going to do a whole series of this, that like, you know, from this point forward, they would work together. You know, yes, mm-hmm. for their clients, but also what's important is finding the truth, which is not how the justice system is supposed to work. But regarding it needs to be adversarial, at least here in America. But yeah, like it's implied that they were, you know, that they had found a way to work together, you know, and be friends. Well, Edgeworth is still baffled at how Phoenix can, you know, not like drown when it rains by looking up with his mouth open like a turkey.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So
do you want to kind of talk about the way the way that the case goes down?
Sure. Do we want to talk about, like, because all the little, each pass of everything that goes back and forth is just, you know,
it's so
too much.
Yeah.
It's so much. We can kind of add to that as we get to it. So this case, kind of like the last one, begins with somebody else's death long time before, and so this case really started with the death of Celeste, the former manager of Juan Carita.
Yes.
So she had actually been the manager at one point for both Matt and Juan.
Mm-hmm.
So in either case, some people believed that Juan had stolen some kind of last written words, but she never left any kind of a note. Yeah. But Juan played up the rumors anyway, I guess for his own, his own rivalry with Matt, because Matt in particular thought, oh yeah, I know what those words on that note said, you know, like as bait. I guess he was baiting Matt, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah. It was implied that this is like leverage that Juan had over Matt. You know, we don't get an awful lot of characterization for Juan. Like we spend all the time with Matt, obviously, because he has the stronger hook. And also he's still alive. But both of them are pieces of shit. Like they both used these women as pawns to get at each mm-hmm. other to extremely tragic results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Juan was, I guess, like messing with Matt by dangling that out there, and they continued to have that rivalry, obviously, after her death. And then once Matt was going to be the winner of the Hero of Heroes reward over Juan's character, then Juan decided that it was time to act and, you know, step up and really beat Matt down. So he ended up plotting with Adrian, Matt's current manager, against Matt.
Yeah.
And they decided they were going to hold some kind of a press conference, and Juan was going to dress as the Nickel Samurai and reveal Matt's history with Celeste to the public and ruin his good image. Yeah. Because wasn't she was engaged to him and they broke it off and then she committed suicide. Yeah.
So she was involved. She was involved with Matt. And then when that fell apart because of Matt's issues, we're going to find out about, she ended up working with Juan and, kind of fell in love with him. They got engaged, but Matt, to put the screws to Juan, said, so just so you know, you're dating my ex-girlfriend, you know, so that was enough to make Juan pull out of the engagement. And so that caused her to lose hope and attempt to kill herself. Mm-hmm. Adrian, her protege, happens to be codependent. She is a very dependent personality, which stands in contrast to the way that she presents herself as, you know, super together and super, you know, type A and assertive. Once the person that she relied on for so much was gone, she also attempted to take her own life.
Yeah. So that's the kind of level we're dealing with these guys.
Yeah.
So they were going to, like I said, Juan's plan was dress up as Nickel Samurai and reveal Matt's history with Celeste to the public to ruin his image. But then Adrian didn't want to do that because she didn't want Celeste's name being dragged through the mud, even in death, you know, for this kind of crap. Mm-hmm. So, but meanwhile, when she's having these meetings with Juan, having these secret meetings to plot against Matt, those got discovered by the tabloids, who then said that they were having some kind of a love affair.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where all of that came in. And then Matt, getting wind of that, ended up putting like spy cameras inside of stuffed teddy bears that he had anonymously sent to Juan, who had like a whole room full of teddy bears from like fans and stuff.
That is so the story behind that is so funny. Like, a part of Juan's like myth making about himself is like, I once fought a bear, you know, and, you know, just so I didn't hurt the bear's feelings because I'm such a good guy, I let him win. And that's why all of his fans are sending him bears, just as kind of like a fun little, you know, it's just a thing, right? It's a thing people do. Fandom is weird. Notwithstanding, if you lose a fight with a bear, you're dead. He eats you. He wants your guts.
Right. Oh man.
Yeah.
So when Matt's got these cameras and he's spying on Juan, he happens to see Juan stuffing like the fake will into, you know, one of the teddy bears, wasn't it?
It's like a little puzzle box is what it is. Oh, it was in the box.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like a jewelry box that was shaped like a bear that like you had to know like the specific steps to take it apart. So only Juan and Adrian would know how to take it apart and look inside.
Gotcha. So, because I was going to say, isn't it a bear? Is it a box? Did I lose my mind completely?
It's okay. Porque no los dos.
It's a box shaped like a bear. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
All right. So, anything can be a box if you try hard enough. So, anyway, Matt finds out about that, and then he ends up contracting a hit out on Juan's life.
That escalated. It'll make more sense once we know more about Matt.
Do you want to go on from there and talk about how that all unravels?
Yeah. So all of this, it's ridiculously complicated, and so much of this is trying to figure it out, which is also borne out because like during the trial, after you blow past the first day and you think Maya's gonna die, ultimately because Matt wasn't sentenced guilty, he lets Maya live. So because things are developing in the background, you're stalling and trying to draw things out. So like the there's plenty of time for this circuitous stuff to to take place.
Oh, and also another thing I wanted to mention about Maya while you talk about that is that something that this particular case does that's interesting is Pearl channels Mia, who tells you how Maya's doing,
mm-hmm.
and that Maya's still alive. So yes. that's how you know, okay, so far they haven't killed her or anything. We know this mm-hmm. and everything. But also there's little segments where you are Maya. You are mm-hmm. playing Maya looking around in Matt Engard's home, and you see like a picture of Celeste or whatever, these different clues, and you can't use them in the trial or anything, but it's piecing together or causing you to have more questions at the right moments in between bits of Phoenix trying to interrogate these witnesses.
Yeah. So. And what's really funny about it is that like everything that you're finding and all of the cases that you're making and all the breakthroughs that are happening are leading toward Matthew Engard being declared guilty, like declaring, you know, like, yes, he is the person who is responsible for this entire, series of events. And it's like, God damn it. We keep on just tightening the noose around Maya. So Matt scheduled a hit with a man named Shelley DeKiller for a hit against Juan Carita. Shelley DeKiller, he has showed up. We see him. He is a very strange looking bellboy. It's like his face has been sewn together after being split in half.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very distinctive look. He sticks out, and obviously there's something up with that guy. But they arrange a time and place for this to happen. And so just after the show, Matt ate his dinner with Adrian, told her, "Hey, I'm going to go and take a nap in my room." But instead, he slipped out as Will Powers was coming to look for him. So Will Powers actually saw him handing the money over to DeKiller, who was dressed up as a bellboy. And Will Powers is like, that is a really huge tip. he's going around handing a bellboy a role. And that's one of the things that helps, you know, tie and say like, yes, Matt was actually taking out this contract hit. And DeKiller is, was the person there as the bellboy. Right. So mm-hmm. Matt goes back to his room, and DeKiller enters Juan's room, and, you know, just saying like, "Hey, I'm here to deliver this, this bottle of tomato juice," and strangles Juan with a scarf. In the scuffle, there's some water that is spilled on top of a guitar case. The juice and the water and this guitar case and a vase that is knocked over ends up being one of the things that initially implicates Adrian in here. Mm-hmm. And Adrian also ends up implicating herself because she stumbles in on this scene, but not before DeKiller leaves his calling card. Whenever he kills somebody, he leaves a playing card with a seashell on it, which is... not a thing that a hitman would do because it would get him caught immediately.
Yeah.
but also he found a bear toy, with the will and then left. So he grabbed this thing because he was also told like, "Hey, take this thing out, get this leverage, you know, off of me. Nobody can read this if it contains what I think it contains."
Yeah. You've got to get that weird box and bring it to me.
Yeah.
So, but when you first see Adrian, she's sitting there fiddling with this card in her hand, right? Like she has that card
mm-hmm.
that she's messing with, like in her animation.
Yeah.
So, she obviously went in there and took something away from there.
Yes.
She says that she thought that, Juan was sleeping. And so she just pours a glass of juice. And I don't know if she said it was for him or it was for her or what it was all about.
Her story changes a couple of times. Like she tries to play it off like, "Oh, I poured this," and her fingerprints are on it, but there are no lip prints on it. Or lip marks or anything like that. She says, "Oh, I was so dazed by seeing the body that I was just in shock and I poured myself some juice." You know, you can't account for why somebody would, do what they do. And the actual story is when she saw Juan, strangled, she thought like, "Oh, he had just fainted or was asleep." So she had poured him some juice to like give him to help him wake up, like after she, roused him. But when she realized that he was actually dead, she started to put her own plan into motion.
Yeah, she immediately ran, booked out of there and went to Matt's room because she automatically was like, if Juan's dead, it's definitely because of Matt, because mm-hmm. that's how their rivalry is. So he goes, or she goes to his room and picks up his knife from the dinner table because it's got his prints all over it. Mm-hmm. And then takes that and then goes and stabs Juan's body with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the blood that dripped off of his body from the knife wound ended up falling onto a button from the Jammin' Ninja costume, which she then put on, you know, planted on Matt to make it, you know, ironclad that this, there's evidence, super evidence that Matt's the one who did this.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And unraveling the order in which the events take place makes it so that, like, he couldn't have taken this bloody, or, you know, this bloody button couldn't have ended up on him in a struggle because he was dead before, you know, Matt ever even stabbed him. Right. Like,
yeah.
You know, so the bloody button would not factor into this death at all. Yeah.
Yeah. But part of the thing that catches Adrian up is that when she's leaving that room after staging all that stuff, she ends up getting noticed not just by Wendy Oldbag, but also by Lada.
Mm-hmm.
So she ended up taking the spare nickel samurai costume, the one that Juan had in his possession, to wear when he did his fake news conference announcing Matt's history with Celeste. She put that on. And because it obviously wasn't going to fit her because it wasn't tailored to her size,
mm-hmm.
The photo of it that Lada caught makes it look really weird because it's super baggy and like everything's dragging on the floor.
Yeah.
So that's another one of the clues about who was in the costume.
That's one of those instant death kind of moments in the courtroom scene. Like, you have one chance to point out, you know, like, can you prove that it wasn't Matt on guard in the costume? And you have to point out the contradiction between the press photo of the nickel samurai and Lada's photo that shows the wildly different heights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. So, you know, she didn't get away scot-free, but it was enough. It was enough to make sure that Matt was the one who was implicated by all of this. And she's desperately saying, no, I didn't kill him. Yes, I committed a crime. My quote crime was tampering with a crime scene, right? It's not good. But you have to believe me that I didn't kill this guy.
Yeah. And at this point, when it comes to the trial, there still isn't enough evidence to convict or acquit anybody. So the judge ends up calling for court to be adjourned. And mm-hmm. meanwhile, Phoenix is panicking because, of course, that means if he doesn't get a total acquittal for Matt on guard, then Maya is going to be killed. Mm-hmm. So at that point, Edgeworth speaks up and asks Adrian about that card she's been fiddling with.
Mm-hmm.
And that card that we mentioned earlier that, hey, guess what? Actual assassins wouldn't use one of those because they would get caught happens to be the point that gets him caught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Miles recognizes it, obviously, as a prosecutor. He has run into these cases that were never solved where this calling card was left behind. So it's immediately like, you know, he calls her a buffoon. Why would you, you know, take that? You know, do you have any idea what this card means? And this rolls us over into the next day. Or no, it rolls us. We have to take a recess. Right. You know, and simultaneously, Phoenix is being asked by his client, by Matt, like, hey, can you go to my apartment and feed my cat? You know, it's right by the hotel. You know, so this starts like an investigation period where you go and you feed his cat. It's an adorable kitty. But this is where you end up going with Miles eventually here with Edgeworth, and seeing that there's, you know, some stuff here, you know, at his house. Like, there's evidence of more cameras and stuff, you know, that have been taken and placed. Like, there's cameras and timers and transponders and stuff. In addition to other things, such as when you get into the basement where Maya was being kept, there's the photo is a picture of Celeste, and it says to Carita, Celeste, right, to Juan. So it's a, you know, establishing that particular link, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a bit of a backtrack or a pause.
Okay.
We never mentioned why Edgeworth is the prosecutor this time instead of Francisca.
You're right.
She got shot on the way to the courthouse.
She got shot at the beginning of the second day. Yeah. So Miles was like hanging around with you and was doing, you know, was doing some of this stuff. She was shot on the way to the courthouse. Mm-hmm. And so Miles has to take over as the prosecutor here, you know, despite Francisco's protestations. Right. She insisted, you know, it doesn't matter if I've been shot, I'm going to go and beat Phoenix. But she had to go to the Hottie Clinic, and there's where we meet Dr. Hottie again. May he burn in hell.
Indeed. So. Yeah. Sorry for that bit of an interlude, but if anybody's wondering, because I realized, you know, people who haven't played this might not know why Edgeworth is suddenly stepping in.
Where did Francisca go?
Reason. He happened to be hanging around.
Yeah.
Conveniently. And then she happened to get shot.
Yes. So. Yeah. And the reason he was shot was the killer knows, like, okay, Matt is being... you know, people are going to find out, and the, you know, the card's been found and noticed. So I didn't intend for anybody to find that thing I left behind at a high profile murder scene. He's arranging his own insurance. You know, he wants to make sure, you know, that that Matt will be found not guilty, kill Francisca, and force a worse prosecutor to, you know, to take over the case the next day. And turns out, actually, no, we got a much better one. And we also got Edgeworth, who is definitely more aware of everything that is going on and working with everybody involved, and also nudging Phoenix toward the actual truth on this.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, so yes. Where were we in the present day? We had the cat, Shu, which that's such a name for a cat, Shu, like S-H-O-E.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So where we are is we're stalling for time because Gumshoe is rushing.
Oh, the video camera. Getting the video camera.
The video camera and the videotape. So Gumshoe is you know, trying to rush analyze this evidence and rush it to the court to the courtroom because you know, potentially this is going to be what we need in order to, well, I mean, it's up to you. You can decide if you want to, you know, have Matt get off the hook. Maya, you know, even tells you, like, no, you need to make sure he's guilty. He can't get away. Don't worry about what's going to happen to me. You know, just this tape will be a decisive piece of evidence no matter what. Also, the framed photo reveals that the will, the suicide note that was inside the bear box, was a forgery. Carita wrote it himself. Celeste didn't actually write anything.
Yep. So, at that point. Phoenix goes to the police station. He finds out that there is a new witness who happens to be Will Powers.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't have any real information about what was going on, but he does have, you know, a little bit of more information about Celeste, which he happens to be telling you right about the time that Gumshoe calls Phoenix up and says, hey, guess what? That very specific bear box thing was purchased by Matt.
Mm-hmm. It was very expensive. It was imported. Like, this has almost nothing to do with anything. Additionally, in the present day, around this time is where we learn that Matt has dissociative identity disorder. He like takes his hair and he lifts it up off of his face. You know, he had big swoopy hair that was covering part of his eye, and reveals, no, he has this horrible scar. And It's very funny because he's in the detention center and he has nowhere to pull this out from as he does his villain turn and goes into his, you know, bad personality, his bad him. He flips up, reveals a scar and pulls from nowhere a snifter of brandy.
Yes. The snifter is very good.
I love it so much.
But the change is so total. Absolutely. Like everything about him is completely different when he does the little switcheroo.
Yeah.
But the brandy is the best.
And that is why there was no Cyclock there. It's because the fake version, you know, the fake front that he puts up, or that other identity, genuinely didn't know, you know, so here's the evil genius that takes over and has been plotting all of this and, mm-hmm. you know, tried to set this up where he could get everything that he wanted, get the rival out of the way, and also ensure that he would not be held accountable for it, even if everything went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he hired that hit pretty obviously because regardless, you know, he's still bottom line at the end of the day, partially responsible for why Celeste killed herself in the first place. And if that got out, it would ruin his reputation, even if, you know, the fact that it wasn't him mm-hmm. revealing the information or whatever came out, you know?
Yeah.
So that's when you get yourself into a bind where you're like, well, you know, for a fact, because he just told you that he is the one responsible for all of this. Now you get to pick, do you want to save Maya or do you want to get him acquitted?
Yeah.
So,
and so your choice ultimately ends up being, Edgeworth's machinations, get the killer onto the stand, under the pretenses that like, oh, I will testify against my client. He's appearing over the radio. It's, you know, pretty mm-hmm. surreal. The radio is sitting on the stand. So instead of getting the actual, you know, animations of the person doing it's, you know, the creepy voice coming out of the box. But he says, you know, oh, my client betrayed me, so I will testify. What he's actually trying to do is pin it on Adrian, right? If I'm going to go down, I'm going to take you with me kind of thing. And he's saying, oh, Adrian tampered with the crime scene after I did my art. So that is that is why I cannot, I cannot brook this. Right. And, mm-hmm. you know, ultimately it comes down to his misunderstanding and what he the way he reveals himself as, a fraud in this case. And no, Matt on guard was actually his client. You know, the person he was trying to protecting is he has never met Adrian. And mm-hmm. In referring to Adrian, uses a masculine pronoun, mm-hmm. saying like, oh, he seemed like an upright man. And that's when everything starts unraveling.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny how they animate the radio to give it the little character in the animations and everything. It's pretty good.
Yep. Oh man. So his testimony is like one of the places where you could where you could get Matt off, you know, that's where you could say like, no, it was Adrian and it was the killer working together, and Matt goes away. That's the bad ending. Like you still never see Maya again because she doesn't mm-hmm. want to have anything to do with you if you're not ethical. So the killer's case comes apart, and then when all of the evidence that Gumshoe is carrying is delivered by Francisca, that is when the news tightens around Matt.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And so at that point, Mia has also, I think she's been possessing Pearl for a while at this point, or she's been doing so off and on. I mean, it's just kind of constant. She basically advises Phoenix that the only way to make sure that Matt is actually convicted is to make him to want that guilty verdict and to confess, mm-hmm. or to convince the killer to let Maya go by getting him to retract his contract. So you can't submit any new evidence, but you get to present a single piece of evidence to someone relevant in the case.
Yes.
So at that point, Phoenix shows DeKiller the videotape that they just got from Franziska, which happens to be one of the videos from the bears that are hiding around the room with the cameras that were planted by Matt Ongard. Mm-hmm. He doesn't trust anybody, and he said that, you know, himself before. So he needed to have a backup plan. And so he recorded everything that happened. And in this case, you know, recorded DeKiller doing the crime just as insurance, just in case. So DeKiller, who is, of course, you know, there's the highest trust between myself and my client, is very outraged by that. And, you know, at that point says, well, the contract is null and void, and I don't need to hold this lady captive anymore.
Because... He calls her an item. Oh, man. Yeah. So he decides, I'm not going to protect Matt anymore. And yep. So the good ending, you know, saying like, okay, well, you know, just are you sure? You know, like you would be a very bad defense attorney if you said, no, my client is guilty, unless that was his plea. And you get to choose. I don't know that I've ever chosen not guilty here. Regardless, he gets killed because DeKiller is going to come after him, or he gets the death penalty. But regardless, yep. he is declared guilty. And Maya is very shortly returned.
And meanwhile, Phoenix is happy that he lost this case because, you know, he might have made the wrong move and trusted in somebody who was corrupt and terrible. But Franziska is very upset about this, that he's happy that he lost, and especially because she wasn't the one who took him down.
it was decidedly unethical collusion between the defense and the prosecution to make this happen. The ACLU would have a field day here, is what I'm saying. you know, Phoenix, his answer to this, like, kind of the theme of this entry is like, what does it mean, you know, to him to be a defense attorney? You know, it doesn't matter that I've, you know, never lost a case. What matters is, you know, we find the truth, right? If he decided to go along with Matt's demand and get Adrian, you know, somebody has to be declared guilty because somebody died. Then the wrong person would be convicted and executed, and that would be on his conscience. So, you know, he has to kind of settle with his own reckon of his ethics in this case.
Yeah, and I think, isn't there like a whole spiel by Edgeworth at this point where he's just like going over, yeah, I had this inner soul searching and I found myself when I went away and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, just like he had, you know, basically grown up, you know, at one point, Franziska says she considers him her little brother, even though he's almost twice her age. but like, you know, he grew up in, you know, in Manfred von Karma's shadow, kind of taking on all of his bad teachings about, you know, winning at all costs and doing all this unethical stuff, and that caused a bit of a you know, an existential crisis for him, and that's why he went away, was to, you know, ponder this and decide if he even wanted to come back, because everything had been a lie up to that point, you know.
Yeah. Well, at that point, you know, at the end of the game, what that triggers is Franziska then going off and to have her, hopefully to have her own soul searching, but I'm not so sure that's what's going to happen, because she gets her whip back.
Yes.
And so like the happy ending is she's gone, guys. And then Phoenix rejoins his strange little family of adopting small children.
Yeah. And she is gone, and that is good. She makes, you know, appearances, you know, intermittently throughout the rest of the series, but she is far less brusque. She gets she gets a little bit more dimension, let's say.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a better, like, I want to say it was one of the first things that happened after I played like a couple of the cases in the first game where I was just like, is anybody ever guilty? I was so bothered. I was like, God, of course that this one's guilty or innocent because, you know, all of Phoenix's clients are just always innocent.
Yep.
You know, and then somebody was like, just you wait until part two. And I'm like, okay, guys.
And it's like, it's not that he's, it's not that he it has never defended a guilty person, you know, it's just, or it's not that it, like he only defends innocent people. It's that he's always right.
Yeah. That's in his name.
It is. He deserves it. It's owed to him. Nominal determinism is the phrase there. Yeah. So I mean, like the wrinkles in the last case, I think it gets a little bit too convoluted, you know, especially when it gets into stalling for time and this kind of ping ponging of guilt back and forth between Adrian and Matt. It gets to be a little bit much for me, but like the twist and turn and, you know, ultimately, you know, the way that this relates to the other cases and, you know, is a non-standard kind of defendant and like, okay, what does guilt mean when your client has multiple personalities? What does guilt mean when they use somebody else to commit the murder? You know, that is again obfuscating culpability and, you know, making the question a little bit less cut and dry about where the culpability lands. You know, same thing with the possession stuff in case number two. Mm-hmm. And same thing to a certain degree with, like, you know, how wrong was Acro, you know, to do this. Actually, very. He killed a person even if it was by accident. But like, you know, an accidental killing is still an accident. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
Well, I like this enough that even though I was waiting to play the third installment until we could at least talk about the second installment, because like it's already been a good 9+ months since I played this game between when I played it and when we recorded. So like I cannot play the third one for at least another 6 months because I need to give you some lead time. And anyway, you're going to be very busy with Elden Ring soon.
Yeah.
But like it's enough that I wanted to see more of it. And so I had pre-ordered the Great Ace Attorney Chronicles, and I enjoyed the first one of that, but I was trying to like spread it out so I don't get like too much at one time, you know, like I'd like to stagger it out. So I get like helpings of it when I'm in the mood for it and then like not overdosing. So I'll probably be playing the second Great Ace Attorney. That one is very, very good. I would definitely recommend we talk about those, but I would have to flat out replay them at that point.
Yeah. That'll be a long time.
I stalled out for sure on the Big Top one for a while, and I had to set it down because it was just too much, too long. Felt too long anyway.
Yeah.
So I had to set it down for a bit before I got back to it. But I otherwise played pretty consistently throughout this second game. Overall, I think the first game was less of a roller coaster, I guess, like insofar as quality of the thing I'm playing. Like, you know, like I might have preferred one or another character or one or another of the cases, but there wasn't like this noticeable dip kind of thing. Although I did like, you know, as you're mentioning, just like the questions that it's raising about, you know, guilt and, you know, what the real purpose of being a defendant, no, like the purpose of being a defendant is to defend your client, but like, you know, at least in the idealization or the wacky world of Ace Attorney, what does that mean to you? Okay, well, finding the truth, because these people are good people. So
yeah. You know, I think if you leave the final case off of the first game, it is just so much stronger than this. you know, like the fifth case is the real nadir of that one. This, you know, I think this is messy. You know, I think that there's a, there's a little bit less of a less of a through line to things. Like I was, you know, it's a reach even to like draw those commonalities of the way, you know, of the ways that it complicates Gilton in a sense, right? And I admit it's a reach. But also like, you know, this is the first game was kind of a story of like Maya and Phoenix kind of getting to know each other and developing. The fact that Maya is sidelined through a bunch of this, and we have Pearl, and really the only case that concerns her is, you know, case two, which is still really good, but you know, it's only one. This doesn't move things forward necessarily in a way that made me really, really crave entry number three, which I think is phenomenal. Based on my memories of it, I just like, even back at the time I was like, oh wow, this is so much better. It is way more dramatic. It has a lot more to do, not just with the phase, but also with Phoenix's past. Like we've never really gotten a real glimpse of that outside of the grade school stuff. And we get a better prosecutor. We get Godot, who is just really good. You know, he's no Miles Edgeworth, but few are.
Well, I have to say too that like part of the driving dynamic for the first game was of course that kind of rivalry between Phoenix and Edgeworth, and they can't truly recapture that after that first game, especially with the way that they resolved it. Because and here, like, Edgeworth is like, no, you have to understand the true meaning of the power. It was inside you all along. is that kind of a, you know, kind of a thing here? And he's kind of a mentor for Franziska. He's kind of a, you know, mentoring Phoenix here. So, you know, it does not surprise me that Edgeworth is also not going to be the main prosecutor in the third game. But also it's like, you know, they didn't realize what they did when they developed Edgeworth and that he would become as popular as he is. Although doesn't he have his own spinoff game or games?
Ace Investigations. Miles Edgeworth. Which plays differently. Like that's a, like that is a an interesting departure.
Well, perhaps at some time I will check that out, especially like if I'm waiting for the Elden Ring stuff to die down and everything else.
I can
slate it in with you for the third one.
Yeah, I would like, I mean, I would like it to be sooner than a year. We should talk offline. What ultimately made me finish this was having a deadline. So, you know, me making the agreement that I would be here to record with you at a particular time lit the fire under me. So, we should talk off air, but it, you know, I have a hankering for entry number three because I remember it being killer. No pun intended.
Was that okay? I was really, I mean, we just were talking about nothing but like there were puns everywhere, flying everywhere this entire time. We've been talking about Phoenix Wright of all things,
but I'm still me, Jala.
You were behaving, you didn't even make any terrible dad jokes.
I know, right?
So we will look forward to playing the third entry, and definitely I would strongly recommend that you play and that listeners also play Great Ace Attorney Chronicles or whatever that's called, Chronicles of the Great Ace Attorney, whatever they call it in America. Great, that one,
Great Ace Attorney Chronicles.
Okay, and I was correct. Great, that one. Play that one, it's fun. It's very good.
This is a PSA, maybe for you, Jala, as well, but for the listeners, just here recently as we're recording, Nintendo had announced that they are in early 2023 they're going to be dropping support for the entire 3DS and Wii U eShop, which sucks. You're not going to be able to buy a bunch of games that are exclusive to the downloadable kind of network that they have there, which is a bummer because there are there are two Phoenix Wright games that were only released digitally, in addition to Professor Layton versus Phoenix Wright, which is very good, by the way, but buying that physically is incredibly costly. I think the thread that I saw today, it's like $150 if you want to get a physical copy of it. So you have a year, but you know, if you are on the fence about getting those things, I would recommend, you know, if you're not going to Google them, I would recommend buying them legitimately while they are still available for you to buy. Cause Sony may backpedal on stuff like this, and then Nintendo don't. No. I would not bet on them stepping back on this one. So just making people aware that there is a ticking clock on a lot of good stuff, including Phoenix Wright stuff.
Gotcha. Good call there to mention that to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I will have to dust off. Find my 3DS and dust it off. I've been on my Switch almost exclusively.
Oh my god, me too. Yeah, we're doing any Ultimate NES Remix on WAF here soon, and I had to get it out and charge it and update it. I hadn't touched it for a good long time.
Yeah. That's okay. There's still some good stuff on there to play. So
cool. Well, I need to go, and I suspect you want to go eat dinner. So thank you, Jella.
I'm hungry, and it has been a very long day. I am ready.
It has. Yeah. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening. This is a bonus episode. You know what to do. Thank you, Jella, for understanding and lighting a fire under me to get back on here. This was fun to do. And next time, it's not going to be as protracted.
Woo.
I've been Cole Ross. You can find me on Twitter at Cole Ross.
I'm Jellachon in Places. You can find me there.
Yeah. And we do not need to pick a title because it's just going to be descriptive. It's probably going to say, you know, bonus level, Phoenix Wright, etc.
Which is sad because throughout the whole time, I was just like, God, there's so many level titles.
What was it? Money Monkeys Contraband Pile or something like that?
I don't know. There were so many of them. I would have scrambled to write them down if I felt there was any reason to.
Oh, well. People can just enjoy them in their natural habitat.
Natural habitat. Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.